Hi, my name is Tom, and I am an alcoholic. And glad to be here, glad to be in Orlando. I woke up this morning in the same place I went to bed last night, and that's a good experience. And I've been able to visit and listen with a number of folks over the last few days, and I'm glad for that. I do like the fellowship. I do like the hanging out. And the saying hello and meeting new folks. I know some people over the years, and some are new to the program, and maybe you haven't met me ever before, so let me give you some data so you can get me on your grid. I notice a lot of folks here give sobriety dates. We don't do that where I live, but it's not bad. We just don't do that where I live. In Texas, they say if you don't give your sobriety date, it's because you don't have a sobriety date. And my first day without a drink was the day that Gerald Ford was nominated for President of the United States. So that's my sobriety date. It was a Wednesday in August. It was the bicentennial year. It was the year that the third edition of the Big Book came out, and I got a third edition of the Big Book, and one of the people that I became great friends with over the years had a he got sober at the same time, but a month later. And they gave him a second edition of the Big Book, so I've always felt more advanced than he because of the 28 days and the third edition of the Big Book. Grew up in California, and I've heard, you know, some folks make the California references. What you might not know is that we in Northern California barely talk to the people in Southern California. You might not know that, but I want to carry that resentment with me into California. They take our water and they make us ration, and there's a lot of problems. So, I'm 64 years old. I got sober when I was 29 years old, and I knew nothing. I'd been in school forever, but I knew nothing. I'm a member of there's alcoholism in my family. A part of the family, you know, Irish Catholic Democrats and Swedish Lutheran Republicans, and we just talked around alcoholism a lot. We never used the word. On the Irish Catholic side of the family, alcoholics were called characters. And they'd say, oh, so-and-so is such a character. And I've met some right from the old country. I mean, we're off the boat. We're new immigration to this country. So my cousin Sean, you know, such a character. What that really meant was do not let him drive. That's what it meant. And the Swedish Lutheran Republican side of the family, we didn't have alcoholics either. We had nervous people. And I'm the youngest, a big Swedish farm family, and I'm the youngest of a lot of cousins. I was a little boy, and my first cousins were married with kids my age. I mean, it's that kind of age span. And every other one's alcoholic, and bad alcoholics. And so I didn't know much about alcoholism when I got here. I didn't know how to talk about it. I have a tendency to talk around things. To use circumlocution, to use euphemism, to use a lot of fancy footwork rather than tell the truth. And I was kind of raised like that. And I was attracted to meetings because where I went to meetings, the truth was told simply and directly. And it was such a change. It was oxygen. I joined the Jesuit community when I was a young man. I was 18. I'd been drunk. I'd been in love. What more is there? So I I joined the community and I was taught by Jesuits, and these were bright fellows, and I was drawn to being a teacher. I liked that kind of life, and I had a vision of ending up teaching school for my whole life, and that would have been fine with me. And I went through the stages of alcoholism that Dr. Gill would talk about, and we have some sober physicians on the West Coast, and I have learned a lot from listening to them. Also, in the book it says we are people who would not ordinarily hang out. I think that's very true. And if you come to AA and hang out with AA people, you'll be surprised who you fall in love with. And you will fall in love with people that you don't think you have much in common with. I have fallen in love with some people in AA before I knew who they voted for. I mean, these are very surprising things, you know. And Dr. Gill was one of these wonderful folks. He passed about 2 years ago. He was in his early 90s. But he got sober when General Eisenhower was president. And then he had a relapse under Mr. Kennedy. And then he got sober again with Lyndon Johnson. And Gill, as a sober physician, he grew up in French Canada and came to the graduated, became a doctor, moved into San Francisco, began his medical practice, and his alcoholism advanced, and he gets sober. And Gill was one of those eloquent people in French and English who could teach you a lot and well. And I would hear Gil talk about alcoholism, and I didn't know anything about alcoholism. Like I say, I grew up avoiding direct conversations about anything real. Gil said alcoholism is a disease that has three distinct phases. Phase one is the fun phase. This is when it's fun. Phase two is fun plus problems. It's still fun, but you start to have problems. And phase three, problems. You know, the good times are gone. So the first step asks a pretty simple question, and the question is, are you still having any fun? And if the answer is yes, you might not be interested in hanging out with us. To want to join us, to think that we are worth hanging out with, you have to be a train wreck. If you still have self-respect and dignity, you're not going to find us very interesting. My sponsor calls this the gift of desperation. If you have the gift of desperation, we're fun. But otherwise, it's just, do I want to spend the rest of my life with those awful people? So I listened to Gil over the years, and my alcoholism is exactly like that. When I was a young person, I drank, and it was really fun. I was an awkward kid. I didn't think I fit in very well. I lived in my head a lot. I was pretty sure that my insides did not match your insides. But when I drank, I felt full of confidence and masculinity in adulthood and power, and I could do a lot of stuff. And that's at 14, 15, 16, and 17 years old. I also want to say I'm a drunk driver. I'm one of those people. I drove drunk for years and never killed anybody, never hurt anybody, but that's next time, you know? I heard a recording of Norm Alpe some years ago, and he was a very prominent AA speaker, I guess in the 50s and 60s, and he talked about his life and his story as being a matter of seconds and inches, a couple of seconds different, a couple of inches different, and it would be a real different story. And I keep that in mind when I think about my years of drunk driving. And I forget, you know, I hang out with drunks a lot, but also I occasionally go to other events. I was somewhere in San Francisco at a party. A party? I don't go to those things. I'm socially awkward, so I don't go. Somehow the topic of drunk driving came up, and I think I was the only person in recovery in the room, and there was a rather elegant lady of a certain age standing next to me, and and the topic, drunk driving. I said, oh, I did that for years. And she said, you were a drunk driver? And the temperature in the room just dropped, you know, to a freezing condition. We did not become friends. But I like mentioning the drunk driving. The longer I'm sober, the more frightening the drunk driving stuff is for me. And if... Can I mention a couple other mild fears? Not big fears, mild fears that I occasionally have. Driving across bridges. Not always, but sometimes. New Year's Eve is a jumpy time for me. And where I live, we have a lot of bridges. And I have been asked to do things like, I live in Oakland, California, and there's a big, long bridge between Oakland and San Francisco. We rarely go there. We stare at them. We call them the West Bay, and it pisses them off, and it's just fun. But I would be asked, we're having a big New Year's Eve AA meeting and dance. Would you come and speak? And I was, you know, the problem is, to get there, I'd have to cross the bridge. And if you could helicopter me over, it would be an easier thing. But anyway, I have gone. And then, you know, the AA meeting's over at 10:30 and the big dance starts. And I just say, I'm leaving now. Because by 11:30 on that bridge, I couldn't cross it. You know, the fear would just be so great. And I used to think that, well, surely this fear will go away as I get. But it doesn't. So I just respect it, you know, and ask God for help and cross the bridge. I also have an occasional trouble with tunnels, but that's a whole other inventory. I had all the symptoms of alcoholism. We talk about blackouts. Oh, yeah. In high school, I was having blackouts. Earlier than that, perhaps even blackouts, I'm not sure. The only time I've ever had an accident, though, was drunk driving on my bike. And so I was maybe in the 7th or 8th grade, and I'd go home. I didn't want to deal with other kids. They got in the way, and I'm busy thinking. So I didn't live far from school, so I'd ride my bike home really fast and then have something to eat maybe, and maybe a drink. And a little bourbon or a little tequila, that was around the house. And on one of those occasions, I do not remember leaving the house. I do not remember getting on my bike. I do not remember heading back to school. I do not remember the telephone pole. I do not remember the ambulance or the police. But evidently, I'd had a couple of social drinks and smacked into a tree. And the cops called my mom. And they said, Mrs. Weston, we have your son. That's how they started. So her first thought was my oldest brother had robbed a bank, because this is how we think in my house. And they said, no, it's your son Tom and Tommy. And, you know, what went wrong? And so they said, oh, there might be something wrong with the bike. And, oh, there might be something wrong with the telephone pole. Or, oh, there might be something wrong with the street. They never asked, had he been drinking? Because when General Eisenhower was president, no one thought that 12-year-olds would be drinking, you know. But I was. So that's the only accident I've ever had. A few years ago, I was asked to come and give a talk to high school people, to parents, about alcoholism. And I gave information, you know, it's your allergy of the body, obsession of the mind, symptoms, recovery, what it looks like. And we had three or four teenagers who were sober come with. And they're the ones they really need to hear, is kids who are clean and sober. But there I was, and one of the parents said, well, can't we prevent all this? You know, can't we just prevent all this happening? And I said, well, my experience was I had all of the symptoms of advanced alcoholism by the time I was a junior here at high school. They didn't want to hear that, you know. Oh, well. One more place I haven't been asked back to share at. Oh, my. So, blackouts and personality changes. I love the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde analogy. I get Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. I was frequently very, very friendly, and frequently I was cooperative. But give me a couple of social drinks and who knows what's going to happen. And I have been known to get involved in impossible arguments and fights over politics and religion. And be dragged off and never be asked back. And I have a big mouth. So I'm not someone who asks for help. Doesn't occur to me. I think if I'm in trouble, I should try harder. And if I'm in trouble, I want to keep it secret. And if I'm in trouble, I don't want to be noticed. The reason I'm still alive today is in my religious community. These are bright people. And in the early 70s, maybe late 60s, they got an education on alcoholism. People who knew about the disease talked to the in the Catholic Church, the bishops and provincials and superiors of orders, and they said, listen, this is a treatable disease. It's big in the Irish, it's big in the Slavic, all your people have a lot of this tendency. And if one of your folks is showing symptoms of alcoholism, get them some help, because you'll save a life. So intervention was the policy, and I surfaced as I'm a loud, very enthusiastic alcoholic who's looking for the car keys. And people had noticed this before, and they were waiting, and one of my classmates, his father was a Teamster, and one of his father's best friend was in charge of all the alcoholic Teamsters. Can you imagine? That is a job. And they got some information, and when it was time, I was intervened on and put into treatment. We had a new boss. I was his first alcoholic. And the timing was right. I was exhausted and burned out and frantic and, like I say, 29. And I was pretty sure my life was over. And I went through a 21-day program in Berkeley. I was going to school in Berkeley at the Graduate Theological Union, which is a great place to learn stuff. 12 different schools, 9 different denominations. Let's do this together. And I got sober there. And when I got sober in 1976... in Berkeley, we didn't quite have one meeting a night yet. And so we had to go next door into deepest Oakland to get to some meetings, which is like 4 miles away. And maybe a few other towns. And then every so often they would say, let's go to a meeting in San Francisco. And I would explain to them about the bridge. But they didn't care. They said, don't drive, sit in the back, close your eyes, we're going. I called AA, and I asked if there were meetings anywhere, because I didn't know. And they said, there's a Friday night meeting in Oakland on Telegraph Avenue. And I went. They did not tell me that it was an old-timers meeting. And everyone was 107 years old. And happy, 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 happy. Friendly. And I've been a little isolated for a while. And I would serve. In graduate school, you go to class, surface, and then you submerge. And that's what I did. So suddenly I'm in a room with people, well-lit room, happy people. Where I got sober, we didn't clap. I got sober in non-clapping AA. And if you were really extraordinary, people kind of nodded their heads and said, far out, but they didn't clap. So that made the room a little quieter, but there I was, and they were all happy, and the topic was, how was your week? And I didn't have a very good week, and someone shared, and someone else shared, and then it was my turn. And I said to these people who were really old and with whom I had nothing in common, I said, my name is Tom and I'm an alcoholic. And they said, hi, Tom, which is, if you're a sensitive person, that's very aggressive. And I said, this was a Friday night meeting. I said, I haven't had a drink since Tuesday night. Now, I didn't go into the details. It was beer. It was beer in a pizza parlor in Santa Clara. I did not get drunk. I did not go to jail. I didn't pee inappropriately. It was just beer in a pizza parlor. And went home and passed out and then saw my boss the next day and watched Mr. Ford get the nomination. And then it was Friday night. And so I told these people I hadn't had a drink since Tuesday night. And when I told these people with whom I had nothing in common that I hadn't had a drink since Tuesday night, they burst into applause. I was genuinely caught by surprise. Because who does that? You know? I had some friends who loved me and they would have that concerned conversation. And I would say, I haven't had a drink in a week. They never clapped. But these people clapped because they knew what it meant to not have a drink since Tuesday night. That gave me a little breath of hope that maybe I wasn't as isolated as I thought I had been. I didn't know there were other meetings. I didn't know there were other groups. But these folks got it. And I've heard other folks talk about that, getting together that first 11 days, that first 19 days, that first month. The miracle of that. Anyone can get 30 years. Jerks get 20 years. Some real creeps get 10 years. But how do you get that first 11 days? I mean, I'm so glad that was the response that was given to me. And then the fellow next to me talked, and I didn't notice him in the room because I was thinking about myself, I guess. But great big guy, younger than me, Vietnam Special Forces, spent a few years in jail. He came back from Vietnam with a lot of skills, which you're not supposed to use on this side of the Pacific. And he had a couple of social drinks and blacked out and inappropriate things happened. And he comes to with a SWAT team on him, dragging him off in chains. And he had a lot of people-pleasing skills, as you could tell. And he went into jail and he made so many people happy, they put him in solitary and he stayed there for months. And one of the guards was sober. And the guard started shoving AA literature under the door. And Gary read the stuff after setting fire to it for maybe a month. And then Gary gets sober in prison and becomes one of the sober guys. And his first parole hearing was very brief. He came and they said, don't sit down. do you have any questions for us? He said no. And it was 5 years later that he talked to them again. Gary had been out of prison about 10 days when he met me. And he told me what we do here. He said, we here in Alcoholics Anonymous go to lots of meetings. We don't drink in between meetings. And we don't use no dope. Well, I had been smoking non-habit-forming marijuana every day for 8 to 10 years. And he told me, we don't do that here. And Mr. Ford and I smoked on Wednesday night. He was getting the nomination. I was having a little cigarette. And Thursday night I did. Friday night I was planning on smoking, but I heard you don't do that here. And I was so ready And I was so dumb. I mean, I didn't know you could leave AA if you didn't like it. I mean, I didn't know you could do that. I just figured you show up and do what they tell you to do. And I started this association with sober people. And it saved my life. It has saved my life over and over and over and over again. And I'm so glad for that. And I have a memory that I haven't talked about in a while. I just want to share that. Before I came to the program and got sober, there were a couple of times I did not drink. Now, maybe a few of you have done that. You know, you got in a situation that was so disgusting and awful and that you just aren't going to drink. And mine had to do with the Berkeley police, and we don't have to get into it. But it was humiliating enough for me. And one of my pals was kind of involved as a witness, so I just stopped drinking. And I'm obsessed with alcohol. My brain works like an alcoholic's brain. I think about it. I notice it. I notice billboards. I notice ads. I was on a plane. I'm on planes a lot, but I notice what people next to me drink and what they don't drink and how fast they drink it. And I sometimes want to give a little advice, you know, but I don't. I was at the Chicago, O'Hare is a very exciting place to walk through, and it was the holidays a few years ago, and people were crazy, and a lot of people don't like to fly, and I usually travel by myself, and it's more than enough just for me to deal with me, but there was a family traveling. There was a mom and a dad and a couple of kids, and one of these kids was a little boy. I'm not good on kids' ages, but maybe 6 years old, 7 years, and this kid was done. You know, they probably flew from someplace and then flew from someplace and are going to fly somewhere else. And this little kid was done. And there are people everywhere and there's chaos everywhere, anxiety everywhere. It's an airport. And this little boy is just crying his heart out. And I wanted to go up to his mom and say, he needs a drink. I recognize this kid. This little boy needs alcohol more than anyone else in this airport. And I've been him. Let him have a little tequila. It'll take the edge off. But I have learned to keep my big fat mouth shut, and I didn't do that. Anyway, there I am. So I'm not drinking. My friend knows I'm not drinking. And when I'm not drinking, that I didn't drink, and that's all I thought about. I'm not drinking. I'd wake up not drinking, I'd have lunch not drinking, I'd go to class not drinking, I'd take a nap not drinking, have dinner, you know, in 6 minutes, not drinking, watch Walter Cronkite, not drinking, and then that's the way it is, and I'd have 5 more hours of not drinking. So I'm pretty tense. And I was at the Graduate Theological Union, and I was at the Jesuit School of Theology and the Church Divinity School of the Pacific, which is the Episcopalian Seminary, invited us over for social. So we went, and all these seminarians, and they're Episcopalians, so they serve sherry in little glasses with fruit, you know. Now, I haven't done that since I was 11. You know, these aren't really adult drinks. And by the way, I'm not drinking, so I'm not drinking. So I'm just. But my friend, who is anxious because he loves an alcoholic and doesn't quite know how to keep his big fat mouth shut, says, as this nice person is bringing a tray of sherry past us, my friend says, "You can't have any of that." Until that moment, I had no intention of having any of that. But I was challenged, you know. And I reached out, I took one of those, and I slammed it back, and maybe I had a second or a third. I remember I had to get out of that very polite, friendly place and get a bottle and go to my room and, to quote Dr. Bob, finish the job. So that's what I'm like. I went to meetings. I didn't drink. I didn't use. I went to meetings. I didn't drink. I didn't use. I got a big book. I had no idea what to do about it. Went to meetings. I didn't drink. And little by little by little, I started waking up and coming out of the fog, they call it, and you know, coming to, and it wasn't pleasant and it wasn't friendly. And I remember being very angry. My first feelings are rage, followed by anger, followed by rage, followed by exhaustion. And I think that's the first 18 months of my recovery. And I went to meetings where you could swear and say inappropriate things and hang out with bad people. And I liked that a lot. I was sober a year, and I finished my studies at Berkeley, and I was supposed to be ordained a priest that year, but, you know, don't make a major change. So my ordination was held up for a year, and you need to do something. So I went back to teach, and I went to Los Angeles. Now, here's the rule. Wherever you get sober is where they do it right. And if you go anywhere else, it's a crisis because they don't do it right. They don't read the book right. They don't do birthdays right. Or they do birthdays. Or they do all this stuff. So I wrote the Archbishop of Los Angeles, and I said, I'm coming down. I'm a sober person. I'll be at Loyola High School. And I said, are there any priests down there who are sober? Because I would like to hang out with some. And he wrote me back and said, welcome. I'll be glad to see you. And when you get to town, call Terry R. And Terry, who is still my sponsor, he's a sober Monsignor. There are very few of them. He, Catholic joke, I apologize. It has to do with the Avignon papacy, and who cares? You know, it's very complicated. When you're in an old church, there's a lot of weird that happens, and you have to explain it to Protestants. But it's kind of like knighthood, you know? So I get to L.A. on a Friday. I go to a meeting. I go to two meetings on Saturday, two meetings on Sunday. Monday morning, I call Terry. And I say, I'm in town, I talked to, I got a letter from the cardinal, he gave me your name. And he said, when'd you get in? He said, Friday. He said, have you been to a meeting? I said, I've been to five. I said, I need a sponsor. I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't know what he drove. I didn't know who he voted for. You know, the big questions of recovery. And he said, I'll be your sponsor. There's a meeting tonight, and I'll pick you up. And he only lived about a mile from me, so which in Los Angeles is intimacy, you know, if it's only a mile. So I started going to meetings down there, and here's my internal process. I don't like anybody, and I don't like anything. The meetings are too big. They're too flashy. They have greeters at the door. God help us. And they clap. They clap constantly. They clap all the way through it. At this particular meeting called the White Flag Men's Stag, which has Skid Row people, disbarred attorneys, doctors not allowed to practice, writers and jazz musicians, that's the group that gathers there, and a couple of clergy. They all sit in a circle, everybody talks, everybody shares some golden insight, and then they clap for every single person. And I was just driven. Anyway, I went to that meeting, everybody united, everybody. And I went to other meetings, and huge groups of people, and I wasn't making friends, and I wasn't relaxing, and I wasn't liking it. And I didn't know what to do. I'm just getting acquainted with me. I'm in my second year of recovery, and I'm back in the classroom now. I had never taught sober in my life. I've taught drunk and I've taught sober. It is easier to teach drinking. I had no tools to deal with stresses and strains and anxiety. I mean, I had just gone to meetings, didn't drink, didn't use, gone to meetings. But I need to develop some other tools. And I only learn new stuff when I have to. When I'm bleeding and on fire, you've got my attention. So I started learning things like telephone, and I started learning things like talking to my sponsor. I mean, what are they for, you know? I had one in Berkeley whom I loved. I could just sit next to him, and it was safer. And my world isn't a very safe place. I mean, there's a lot of awful out there. I still think like that. I mean, I have not become an optimist just because I'm sober. I consider myself a pessimist with a good attitude. That's what I consider myself. But I get bleak, you know, in three thoughts. Boom, 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 I'm bleak. So what do you talk to your sponsor about? Well, I finally said to him, after I'd been there 6 or 8 months, I said, deep secret confession, I'm not making friends. Are there any small meetings in Southern California? Big, you know. And he said, try a big book study. They are always small. And I think that's in our bylaws. So I looked at the meeting directory, and 1,000 meetings a week, Los Angeles County. There was a big book study meeting in a Korean church on Olympic Boulevard, Friday nights at 8. And I started going there. And there were 12 to 18 regulars. I was just turned 30, and these people were in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. And over the next year, they became my first friends. People I could hang out with a little bit, not a lot. You know, look forward to have conversations with. And my sponsor would regularly come to that meeting, too, and I got a chance to see him. And I still like to see him. I was, this past year, I was speaking somewhere at a convention in Bakersfield, which is about an hour and a half from L.A. It's in the in the desert area. And I suddenly realized I'm an hour and a half from my sponsor, and I could stand to see him. So I called him. I said, are you home? Yes, can I come and see you? Just to see you. You know, I've only been sober 34 years, and I feel safer when I sit next to you, and can we have lunch? And then we talk about stuff, some of the stuff that comes up, you know? I thought I would be over resentments by now. No, 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 fresh ones come. So I slowly learned how to do it differently. I'm still not a clapper. But I can go to meetings where people clap and I don't have to hate it. I just live and let live, you know. You go clap. And with so many meetings, going to different places and going to... And I find that every so often, I'll hate a meeting. Well, there are other meetings to go to. Pretty steadily over the last years, I've gone to meetings. And I just don't go. I want to participate. I want to hang out regularly. Oh, God. All right. I was at a meeting recently. And I hated everybody in the room. Idiots. Fools. Inappropriate sharing. So I called my sponsor, and I said, you know, I think I'm done with meetings. What I wanted him to say was, you are so spiritually advanced, you don't need to go to meetings anymore. You can just think about yourself, you know, and be fine. So I'm at the computer so I can type a few of these things down. And I said, so, you know, I just hate it and I hate everybody. And here's what he said, and this isn't quite accurate, but it's close. He said, the suffering we go through at meetings when people share in inappropriate, narcissistic, and awful ways, that suffering purifies the soul like nothing else. See, I don't want to hear that. We have one guy at my home group, whenever he shares, I go to the bathroom because he's so awful. He says the same five stupid things every week. Same one, for years. And now I wait to pee until he's done sharing. Now I'm hoping for some purification and some growth. So I lived in L.A. for 4 more years, and then it was time to leave. I got tired of teaching. What happened was I stopped liking the kids, and that means it's time to leave. Also, I was teaching. I was surrounded by young people. I'm getting older. I have no Al-Anon program yet at all, so I'm not able to set boundaries or let go or detach. I'm involved in all the crazy, and I don't like the kids, I don't like their music, and I don't like what they're watching on TV. And that means it's time to get a new job, is what it means. So I did. I moved up to Oakland and did different kinds of things. And I found, I got a job as an administrator and a fundraiser for an agency in West Oakland. And I was there for 3 years. And my first time as an administrator and a fundraiser and the hirer and the firer, and I found that I learned things I never wanted to know. Boy, was that an uncomfortable 3 years. And I had to develop tools that the program gives us to deal with great discomfort and exhaustion and conflict, learning how to live life on life's terms, which is not an easy experience for me. I heard this at a meeting. Someone mentioned it yesterday, that alcoholism is a lot like dancing with a gorilla. You're not done dancing until the gorilla is done dancing. And I like that image because it talks about lack of power. I like a good gorilla. I think some gorillas are great fun. But when the gorilla gets his arms around me, the gorilla's in charge. And the gorilla will have you do things you never thought you'd do. It kills a lot of us. I didn't notice that till I was about 10 years sober. But a lot of people do the gorilla one more time and end up dead. One of my pals in Vegas says, I don't want to dance with the gorilla. I just want to pet it a little bit, you know, a little bit. If you're clean and sober today, it means the gorilla has let go. You didn't beat it. Even though you're smarter, even though you're taller, it just let go. If the gorilla has let go, get out of the cage. And don't go back into the cage even when the gorilla starts humming your song, which it will do. No, that'll never happen to me. Not after that last awful time with the policeman and the goats. No. I have some self-respect, you know. And then you've got a month or 6 months or 2 years and you hear music. Boy, I'm a middle-class white guy, and I'm, you know, in early old age. And in the last 2 years, two pals of mine, guys that looked a lot like me, one sold insurance, one taught high school kids, They'd gone to meetings and they'd been sober. Both were found in the same month, one in Long Beach, one in San Francisco, dead in the bathroom with a needle in their arms. Heroin's back for old guys. Heroin's back. And that means I shouldn't do heroin today. See, that's the conclusion. Stay out of the cage. Now, people who love us visit the zoo a lot. And they look at lions and tigers and bears. And then they go by the gorilla cage and they see the person they love dancing with the gorilla. Might be their mom or their dad or their brother or sister, their husband and wife, one of their kids, one of their grandkids. Each one of those is its own special crazy, by the way. And they want to do something. So they get into the cage and they start sweeping and vacuuming and moving the furniture around. Making nice, nutritious lunches. When that doesn't work, they try to get between the gorilla and the person they love to save a life, and the gorilla turns on them and yanks their arms and legs off. Which is why they have a program. And it's called Al-Anon. And a lot of Al-Anon comes down to this. Stay out of the cage. But I only want to vacuum. We know. And it's a very bad idea. We're over by the giraffes, and we're talking about our vacuuming needs, and we would love to see you. And we can have that conversation. I think I am more alcoholic today than I was 30 plus years ago. The difference is you've taught me some skills and some tools to use. So that I have an idea of how... A regular one, I go to a retreat for priests in recovery in Southern California every January. I've done this for years. The first, my sponsor made me go, and you know how they are. And I went, and it was just full of these old, fat men with cigars and Bermuda shorts. How humiliating. And... Now they're all my age. I don't know how that happened, but anyway, a few years ago, one of the fellows who presented to us is a priest of the Episcopal Church and named Jeff, and you talk to these guys, and he said, "Okay, listen, I'm talking to a room of bright people. Let me tell you something. Surrender first, then think about it." See, what I want to do is think about it first. I want to analyze it and take some surveys. And then negotiate it. And work it out. Surrender first. That gift of desperation. The war's over. You lost. I asked my sponsor, "Well, how do you surrender appropriately? You know, let's think about this." And I told you this awful group he has on Monday nights is called the White Flag Men's Stag. So in the middle of the room, this guy's in a big circle. There is a block of wood and a white flag just hanging. And I was going to that meeting for months before I noticed because I was thinking about myself. But... my sponsor suggests that when you're done, you just wave the flag, you know, in a public place for just a few minutes. And AA members will come up and talk to you. You can do this in airports or schools. Surrender first. He also said this, one of his first prayers every morning is, "Oh God, protect me from myself." I did not have to raise my hand and ask Him to explain that. You know? Protect me from myself. Because, I had a few ideas a couple years ago that were completely innocuous and simple, and I didn't have to tell my sponsor. See, that's, bink, underline that. When I notice that I don't really need to mention this to him, it's a pretty good sign I should mention it to him. And I told him one of my deep insights, and he said, "I don't know of anybody who's been able to do that and stay sober. Keep me posted." Is that a yes or a no? You know, is my question. I have a... So my life is significantly better. I know we have, relationships. In recovery, we develop friends, companions, and allies. Friends, companions, and allies. And that's done slowly over time. A lot of this starts just by saying hello. Hello. And then things happen. I want to do the footwork. I want to do the step work. I want to use the tools. I ask God for help, and I leave the results in God's good hands. One of the things I've studied philosophy for years, and I've studied theology for years, and I've read the church fathers, and I've listened to rabbis, and I have connections with the Buddhist community, and there's a lot going on, and there's a lot of points of view. And one of the things I really do believe about God, as I understand God, is that God is very big. God is very big. God is bigger than I think. God is bigger than I imagine. God is bigger than the United States. God is bigger than the Vatican. God is bigger than the Bible. God is extremely, very, way big. And I want to keep that in mind as I turn my will and my life over to the care of God day at a time. C.S. Lewis will say, relying on God has to begin all over again every day, as if nothing had yet been done. Today is what's real. Relying on God, get me from here to there. Help me get out of bed. I can't stand it. Help. Get me to the shower. I have days like that. If you could, oh God, help me just get to the shower. Oh God, help me not pee on myself. Oh God. This is called having a simple faith. And the morning prayer, help me, help me, help me, help me, help me. The evening prayer, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Daily reprieve. I don't know all your Florida stuff. I watch you people, but I don't know all your Florida stuff. In California, we have the death penalty, and the reprieve is really only granted by the governor. And it's a matter of life and death. The daily reprieve from my alcoholism, from all my negativity, from all my defects of character, which I still have, but I have a daily reprieve from them. I mentioned this at a meeting, and someone said, if you did it properly, they'd be removed. I said, like judgmentalism? We're not close. That person and I. But the gift of today, and I want to say one more thing, and then we're all done, and we can all go home. And I spoke at Florida in St. Petersburg a few years ago, and we had Hurricane Francis. That was my first hurricane. I want to thank you for that. And now it's 100 degree heat, which I want to thank you for too. But I get drinking dreams. And Joan Larkin, in one of her poems, says, "My dreams remind me of what I used to be." And I get these sometimes. And I didn't understand them. Very vivid. You know? And I was sober a couple of years, and I was having these awful dreams where I'd be drunk, or I'd be driving drunk, or this happening. And I wanted to talk to my sponsor about it, but you don't want to give your sponsor too much information, you know? Because I want him to think well of me. You know how advanced I am. My nobility quotient. So I said, "What does it mean if someone in a different state is having drinking dreams?" And he said, "Have you had the one yet?" And then he described this deeply perverted, nasty dream, which I had never had. And I recoiled as from a hot flame and said, "Absolutely not." And then 6 months later, I had that dream. I said, "What do these things mean? They're very upsetting." He said, "Well, a couple of things." He said, "Number one, drinking dreams mean that for us, our drinking has become a nightmare." And I like that. I like that, the nightmare. He also said this: people who have drinking dreams don't get drunk. He said, "Did you ever have a drinking dream while you were drinking?" I said, only sober people get them. So it's very weird. But when I get them, sometimes I wake up very confused and very troubled, and I'm thrown off base, and I realize it was only a dream. And then I usually call a couple people and talk about it. I say, "I just had another dream. I'm sponsoring a fellow who's... I have a couple of guys I sponsor, and most of them don't call, so it's really easy. But a young man who's a gangbanger, covered with tattoos and jail time. We have so little in common, but we get along just fine. And we've had conversations. He's bought his first car rather than stealing it. It's such an advance. He likes stealing red cars, you know, and I understand that. We were getting used to each other, and we went to San Antonio together and looked at all. He had a great time, and life's good. He'll have almost 2 years now. I gave him the talk you give sponsees about how there's a lot more to not drinking than not drinking. You have to let go of old behaviors and learn new behaviors and develop new skills and new friendships and new relationships and do blah, 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 all that stuff. New stuff. And he listened. He's a bright, bright kid. And he said, "I am hanging out with an old white guy." He said, "I am changing a lot." And when we do hang out with unlikely people, change really does happen. Change really does happen. So I want to just say this is a whole new way of doing things. And, on a daily basis, I ask for enough. Give me enough faith, enough hope, enough kindness and charity to last through the day. And by the end of the day, it's gone. By about 10 p.m., I'm done. I used to call people back at 10 p.m. I no longer do that because I have nothing to say. But to ask for enough, if you're new to conventions and conferences, these are fun. The first couple I went to were roller coasters for me. Up, down, up, down. It balances out. And if you had a good time here, if you had a terrifying time here, come back. And think of the international conference in Atlanta, Georgia in just a couple years. I've been going to international conferences since my sponsor made me go with him to New Orleans in 1980. And Marty Mann, who's right over there, and Lois Wilson, who's in a couple of these pictures, were still alive, and they were both there, and they waved at us. I had been waved at by Lois Wilson and Marty Mann. And I'm sure that's helped my sobriety. So if I don't see you before then, I hope to see you in Atlanta in 2015. Thanks a lot.